Okay, good evening, everyone. So this evening we're speaking about a topic that was actually suggested by our dear friend Maurice, and on that note I'd like to just put it out there that I Baruch Hashem, have a never-ending list of things to talk about, but if anyone has any suggestions ever, I'm always happy to talk about it. And so the question came up of what do Jews of the Southern Hemisphere do, right? Because those of us who are, it's a broad question, but those of us who are New Yorkers understand that there is not really anything south of New York. But in the real world, there is really something south of New York, like a whole other rest of the planet. And in particular, we know that there is a northern hemisphere and a southern hemisphere. Now, the northern hemisphere is what we would call, those New Yorkers of us would call the real world. And the southern hemisphere is not the real world, but there are people who live there, and there are even Jews who live there as well. Now, the number one difference between the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere is? Right, the seasons are totally flipped, right? And so when it's winter here, it's summer there. And when it's summer here, it's winter there. The logic is undeniable. And so the truth is, though, that because of the way the Jewish calendar works, there are so many different layers of questions that we have to ask trying to understand how the Jewish calendar, which is clearly designed for people who live in the northern hemisphere, how it does fit into people who live in the southern hemisphere. Right? So what are some examples that we might need to be concerned about when it comes to the totally opposite weather situation that we have from northern to southern hemisphere? Okay, good. So, all right. So, Pesach and Sukkot, right? So, Pesach, we know, is supposed to be in the spring, and Sukkot is supposed to be in the fall. They both are different holidays that represent the Exodus, but specifically, the rabbis talk about the fact that Sukkot has to be in the fall, and it can't be in the spring, because on Sukkot, it's much colder. Is it cold on Sukkot in Australia?
Probably not.
Really, it's not cold in a lot of places on Sukkot, except for like Rochester. But the truth is, at the end of the day, Sukkot is clearly colder in the northern hemisphere than in the southern hemisphere, usually. And so that just does not work. And so what do we make of that? And there are many additional questions. For example, like we say in our davening, we say, Mashiv haruach umorit hageshem and v'tein talu mater, in which we're mentioning the fact that Hashem brings rain and we're asking God for rain. But of course, the rainy season in the northern hemisphere is different than the rainy season in the southern hemisphere. And just like we don't ask for rain for parts of the year in the northern hemisphere because it could be detrimental to crops and the like, well, the specific times that we are asking for rain in the northern hemisphere, those might specifically be the times that it's detrimental in the southern hemisphere. And so how could we ask for rain the same time? But what, I'm gonna have a different...
Are we actually asking for rain in Israel,
though,
not here?
Oh, okay, good. Well, we'll get there, Sam. Yes and no. But certainly as a base question, you have to wonder how exactly this should work, right? So Sam brings up a good point. We'll just address it right off the bat. There is basically this explanation that it's really that we're davening for the weather in Israel and not necessarily all over, but it's not across the board accepted that that's absolutely true, right? So many people will actually say that there is a reason that we're davening for rain in New York, and it's because we have crops here too, and we want Hashem to impact the weather here too, right? So it's not totally agreed upon what you're saying, Sam, but it is certainly one of the solutions that we'll come upon. Okay, so with that, before we go any further, just a few additional points that are worthwhile making. One is that there is no mention of the Southern Hemisphere in Jewish sources, certainly in the Torah, and certainly not in the Gemara, not even in the times of the Rishonim in the Middle Ages. Why not?
Because we didn't know about Earth.
All right, because no one knew it existed, which runs us into a very strong potential theological question, which we'll get to in just a moment. before we get to that question, I also just decided to make up a list, which is not as easily findable as you might think it would be online. I sort of pulled this data together from different sources. But these are a whole bunch of the cities that are in the Southern Hemisphere, and the numbers that you see next to them on the list are basically the number of Jews who live in these cities. Right? So there are thousands upon thousands of Jews who live in South Africa and Argentina and Australia. I think, if I'm not mistaken, Buenos Aires is like in the top 10 Jewish cities size-wise in the world, which, again, for those of us in New York, it's hard to believe, but that's how the world works. There is a world outside of New York. And right, so there are all these countries that have significant amounts of Jews. And so what do they do? How do they celebrate their Judaism? It seems to be that it should be identical, but how could it really be identical? Because so much of the season, so much of the halacha that we follow is often based on weather patterns that we experience. So these are our two questions that we're going to be asking today. Number one, how do we understand the practice that these communities should have? And number two, how do we theologically approach this? Because it's true that the Torah and the Gemara and the Rishonim and basically all rabbis and commentators in Torah that we have before the Southern Hemisphere was properly discovered by the rest of the world, no one really talks about it. And so, as we'll see, it's one thing to say that even the great rabbis, maybe even they didn't know it existed, but you like to believe that God knew it existed. And if God knew it existed, well, how come it doesn't come up anywhere, not even hinted to, or something that you would like to point to? And so that is going to be some of the major questions we talk about towards the end. To get right into it now, we have one major halachic category in which that is dealt with in regards to this issue, and it is this question of mashiv haruach umorid hageshem and v'tein talumata, right? So when we insert the ask for rain in our Shemona Esrei, right? So we know that in the Northern Hemisphere, there is a difference between outside of the land of Israel and in the land of Israel, right? So in the land of Israel, they start asking, so we're just going to do a very quick introduction to this for those of us who aren't aware. On Shmini Atzeres, that's when we start mentioning rain. We start saying Mashiv Haruach Umorid HaGeshem. That is inserted into our Shmona Esrei that we say every single day. Then, depending on where you live, there is an additional insertion of V'tein Talu Matar Lavracha, which is basically our request of saying, hey God, please give us rain. And so if you live outside of Israel and in the Northern Hemisphere, you start saying that on December 4th or 5th. As to how we get to December 4th or 5th, that is beyond the scope of what we're talking about now. That's even more technical and complicated than what I want to deal with this evening. But that is the general rule. When you live in Israel, so we start saying it about a month and a half prior to that. And so ultimately, we have these major declarations that we are making. One is the mentioning of rain, and the second is the asking of rain. And again, when it comes to mentioning rain, so that should seemingly be uniform across the board, whether it's the Northern or Southern Hemisphere, because we're just simply talking about the fact that God brings rain and that he is the mighty God because he's able to do this. So that's not as much of a question. It's really this question of asking God to bring rain, assuming we're talking about not just Israel, but the entire world. Well, can we ask God to bring rain everywhere at the time of year that it may not be good for all the places, namely that there may be a difference between Northern and Southern Hemisphere? And so let's begin, let's break into this question. And as we'll see, even though in the times of the Gemara and the times of the Rishonim, they weren't aware of the Southern Hemisphere, they were aware of certain areas in the Northern Hemisphere that had different kinds of climates, that it may not have been good to have rain. And so the question came up then as well. And so that's what the going to be the main crux of the conversation, and we'll develop it beyond that. And I will warn that if you feel like it's been a little technical over these last 6 minutes since we started, it's going to be a more technical class, but God willing, we'll go through it methodically. And if anyone has any questions, as always, please feel free to interrupt and ask them. So if you take a look at source number one, there is a Mishnah that we have in Tainus, the very opening Mishnah of Maseches Tainus, in which we have this question: from which date does does one begin to mention the might of the rains? By inserting the phrase, he makes the wind blow and rain fall. That's Mashiv HaRuach Umurid HaGeshem. And we say this in the second blessing of the Shemona Esrei. So there's a whole list of opinions. Rabbi Eliezer says the phrase is inserted from the first day of Sukkot. Rabbi Yeshua says it's from the last day of Sukkot. Rabbi Yeshua says to Rabbi Eliezer, since the rain is nothing other than a sign of a curse during the festival of Sukkot, as rainfall forces Jews to leave their Sukkot, why would one mention the might of rain during this period? And Rabbi Eliezer says to him, I too did not say that it's proper to ask for rain at this time, but to mention it. And so they have this back and forth, again, very technical conversation, and we end up concluding, according to Halacha, though we mention the might of God for bringing rain, we start that on Shmini Atzeres, which according to Halacha, Shmini Atzeres is not really technically part of Sukkot, right? Because Shmini Atzeres is its own Chag. And so again, that's also a bit of a complicated topic, not for right now. But Shmini Atzeres is the final day of Sukkot, which is also technically the day after Sukkot. And that's when we start mentioning the might of God with the rain. Now, the Gemara in Tainis asks the following question about a city called Nineveh, right? We are maybe familiar with Nineveh. How do we know the city of Nineveh?
Yonah,
right? So our good friend Jonah, the book of Jonah, it's all about the city of Nineveh. So there's an interesting reality about the city of Nineveh. Take a look at source number two. The Gemara relates a story on a similar topic that the inhabitants of Nineveh sent a question to Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. People such as us, they say, who require rain even during the season of Tammuz, which is the summer months, and who live in the northern hemisphere summer, and who live in areas where rain falls all year round, what should we do when there is a drought during the summer, right? So there are some places where rain is necessary all year round, or even during times when most of the northern hemisphere does not get or does not need, but some places do need, even in the northern hemisphere. So he says, are we likened to individuals or are we likened to a community? The Gemara explains the practical difference between these two options. Are we likened to individuals, and therefore we pray for rain in the blessing of Shomea Tefila, right? So there is a blessing that we know in our Shemona Esrei. Literally, it's in English, who listens to prayer, in which we're invited to insert any of our own tefilot, right? So if someone really feels like asking for rain, or asking for a new Lamborghini, whatever it might be, so this is a really great paragraph to insert that request in. And so it shouldn't necessarily be driven based on rainy season or not rainy season. Maybe you could just always ask for rain in this specific blessing. And so if it's an individual request, so do you put it in this paragraph of who listens to prayer? Or are we likened to a community and we pray for rain in the ninth blessing, which is called the Birkat Hashanim, which is where we always insert the blessing, the insertion of Etein Talamatar? Do we do that like we would in the winter months now in the summer as well, even though most others aren't doing that? Or do we put it in the blessing of Shomea Tefila, which is, of course, the blessing of individual requests? So he sent his answer to them, and he says, you're likened to individuals, and therefore you pray for rain in the blessing, who listens to prayer, right? So with that answer, basically we understand, we could stop the whole class right now, that if you have a community that is different than the rest of the general population of the Northern Hemisphere, then you still have to generally act like the Northern Hemisphere. And if you want to put in a little additional insertion, you can, but it has to be in the paragraph of Shomea Tefila, where you make your own personal requests. Okay, the Gemara raises an objection from a Braita. Rabbi Yehuda said, when do the halachot concerning the times during which the prayer for rain is recited apply? When the years, meaning the climate, are as they ought to be, and the Jewish people are living in their land, right? So now the Gemara says, well, wait a second. Typically, when we talk about a specific climate and a specific pattern to the tefillot, we're talking about a very specific reality of the world, which is that the Jewish people are living in their land as they should be. But if they're not, then it's a whole different story. However, nowadays, when the Jewish people are dispersed around the world, and the climate is not always as it ought to be, I don't know what that means exactly, global warming or something like that, all is in accordance, that was a joke, all is in accordance with the year, meaning the local climate, all is in accordance with the place in question, and all is in accordance with a particular time, and therefore, one prays for rain in the blessing of the years as necessary for the local climate. So, when does a person ask for rain, saying v'tein talu matar, which part of Shemona Esrei do they put it in? They always put it in the Birkat Hashanim, as long as it is the rainy season for that time. Which, again, with that, we would therefore conclude that Northern Hemisphere, Southern Hemisphere, wherever you live, if it's the rainy season, you ask for rain. If it's not the rainy season, you don't ask for rain. And it's as simple as that. And so, therefore, if there is a difference, which you would assume there would be, between the Northern and Southern Hemisphere, it's not entirely true, by the way, that even though the seasons are different, the rainy season is not necessarily as different. But if it is, one can still go ahead and just say, wherever it is rainy season, you ask. Wherever it's not, you don't. Oh, okay, so you'll have one city that will be totally different than another city? Okay, listen, if you really believe in the power of prayer, then it makes sense to have differences if you live in different places. If you live in more of a desert land, you're going to need water more. And if you live in a highly populated area with water, then you're not going to be necessarily as in need. So you have to ask different things based on where you live differently. Okay. He said to him, you raise a contradiction from a braita against Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi himself is a Tana. You know what? I'm not going to go through this part. It just sort of adds layers of technicalities. But so the point is, the Gemara seems to conclude that whenever you have an individual city like Nineveh, so the people will go ahead and daven. I apologize. Let's read the conclusion of the Gemara. The Gemara concludes, and the halacha is that if rain is required when it is not in the rainy season in Israel, one prays for rain in the blessing. Who listens to prayer? Okay, so now basically what the Gemara is saying as a conclusion is that if it is not the rainy season in Israel, but you do need to ask for rain for your community, because you are in a place like Nineveh that needs rain even in the summer, so then at the end of the day, you would not include it in the typical blessing that we ask for rain in. Rather, you'd put it in the Shomea Tefillah paragraph, the paragraph that talks about our individual needs of God listening to our prayer. So that is the conclusion of the Gemara, which again, to put that into context, based on the conclusion of this Gemara, you would assume that if the Southern Hemisphere has the opposite rainy season as the Northern Hemisphere, so then you would go ahead and just, you can ask for rain, but just not in the typical place, not in the Birkat Hashanim, you would do it in the Shomea Tefillah. Now, the main question that the Rishonim, that the medieval commentators will wonder based on this is, okay, so how does this apply to larger areas? So Nineveh is one single city. What if you have like a whole country? Or what if you have a whole, you know, massive area, right? A city is a small little city, you know? Okay, so maybe the halachot should be different. And so basically what we have is a potential argument between two of the Rishonim. And I say potential argument because one of the individuals, so the Rambam lived first, and he was a Sephardic commentator. And then we have the Rush, who lives shortly after him. And the Rush goes ahead and has, according to many, he and the Rambam disagree. But according to the Rush himself, he says, we don't disagree. Right, so it's an argument according to most, except for one of the people in the argument who says, no, we're not actually arguing. Right, so let's see now what these opinions are. So the Rambam says as follows. He has two different statements that he makes. One statement is in his regular Mishnah Torah, which is his corpus of halacha, and then one is in his Perush Mishnayot, the commentary that he wrote on all of the Mishnah. Now, unfortunately, because he wrote these at different times in his life, tends to happen, his opinions changed every now and again. And so there is a contradiction, seemingly, between these two statements that he makes. And that is, of course, the source of all of the tumult of trying to understand exactly what the Rambam says. So here's what he says. First in the Mishnah Torah, first in his Hilchot Tefillah, where he talks about the laws of prayer. So take a look at source number 3. Beginning from the 7th of Marcheshvan, one petitions for rain in the blessing of prosperity. That's the Birkat Hashanim. and continues to do so as long as one mentions the rain. Where does the above apply? To Eretz Yisrael, to Israel, we start on the 7th of Cheshvan in Israel. However, in Shinar, Syria, Egypt, and areas that are adjacent to or similar to these, one petitions for rain 60 days after the autumnal equinox, which basically is how we get to December 4th or 5th. Again, the math is not perfect, but not for right now to talk about that. But that is the explanation how we get to why our date is different than the rest of Israel. Okay, he says further, in places that require rain in the summer months, such as the distant islands. Again, what does he mean by distant islands?
Cyprus.
Right, so it's not entirely clear. Is he talking about Papua New Guinea? Probably not, right? So, but okay, the distant islands, they petition for rains when they need them in the blessing of one who hears prayer, right? So the Rambam seems like he's saying exactly what the Gemara that we just read says. If they need rain when most of the northern hemisphere does not need rain, great, let them ask for rain, but they can't ask for it in the Birkat HaShanim blessing like the normal procedure would be. They ask for it in the Shomea Tefillah blessing because that's where the individual prayers go. Okay, that's one statement of the Rambam. Now the Rambam says in a different context in his Perush Mishnayot in source number 4, he says, and it's a rough translation, how can one who is in a place where rain is unwanted ask for rain in the wrong time? Isn't this just an absolute lie? Right, so let's contextualize this. If there are cities that need rain in the summer, well, the odds are they probably don't need rain in some of the earlier months when the rest of the northern hemisphere is asking for rain, right? So there are two issues, really. There's one, can I ask for rain not in the normal time because in my city I need rain, whereas most of the rest of the northern hemisphere doesn't? And can I ask for rain along with the rest of the northern hemisphere when I don't actually need the rain, right? So there's two different questions we have to ask. So says the Rambam, how can one who is in a place where rain is unwanted ask for rain in the wrong time? Isn't this just an absolute lie? And to put this again into language that we could understand for northern versus southern hemisphere, if southern hemisphere weather is the total inverse or converse?
Inverse.
What's the difference? What's converse? What's all right, fine.
The southern hemisphere is upside down.
It's inverse. Okay, fine. So if the southern hemisphere's rainy season is the total inverse of the northern hemisphere, so, okay, fine. Maybe they have to ask for rain at a different time, but can they also ask for rain when we're asking for rain? Like, is their Shemona Esrei going to be different than ours the entire year? Or is it just going to be different in a part of the year? That's really the big question. It would therefore seem that the rain should be asked for in the right time for the location you are living in, seemingly in Birkat HaShanim, right? So now the Rambam makes this striking statement. All of a sudden, we're no longer talking about Shomea Tefillah. We're no longer talking about the paragraph of, you know, God listening to our individual prayers. He's saying that the rain is asked for in the right time for the location that you're living in that specific paragraph that we always do. And so what the Rambam means now, that's the source of tremendous discussion. Let's leave interpreting the Rambam aside for 1 second, and let's take a look at what the Rush has to say. If you take a look in source number 5, so this is also a rough translation, but we'll get the basic gist. He says as follows, it was in the year 5073, after the creation of the world, that it rained very little the entire winter, and the community declared a fast day to beseech Hashem for rain. On the first night of Pesach after Maariv, the Rush was sitting in the entrance to his house, with some of his disciples standing about him, when he declared, "Now is the time to raise a matter that has always bothered me. Why don't we, like, what keeps you up at night?" So this kept the Rush up at night. "Why don't we continue reciting V'tein Talu Matar until Shavuos?" Right, so you would think that you only have to do it until the end of until the end of Pesach, but maybe we should do it until Shavuos. He was really bothered by this. What bothered the Rush is that although in Israel rain is disadvantageous in the summer, in Europe where he lived his entire life, rain was not only helpful in the summer, but it was essential. since rain was important after Pesach, they should recite Mashiv HaRuach Umorid HaGeshem and V'tein Talu Matar even in the summer months. That's what was bothering the Rush. Subsequently, the Rush penned a lengthy response advocating this position. He rallied the following proof. When analyzing a dispute quoted in the Gemara, we ordinarily assume that the two differing authorities disputed concerning a relatively minor issue and held as closely as possible to one another's position. The specific application of this principle is as follows, that both Rabbi Yehuda and Rav Nachman held that the city of Nineveh should recite V'tein Talu Matar in the bracha of Birkat Hashanim. On the other hand, Rebbe and Rav Sheshes contended that the city of Nineveh should recite V'tein Talu Matar in Shomea Tefillah because the city should not have its own practice of reciting V'tein Talu Matar in Birkat Hashanim. However, reasoned the Rush, the dispute among these great scholars regards only a city. A large region or country should recite V'tein Talu Matar in Birkat Hashanim, according to all opinions, just as we see that the practices of Israel and Bavel were not the same, but each country followed its own needs, right? So says the Rush, it's okay to have two different Jewish communities that are far apart from one another have different practices. Okay, does it look a little silly sometimes? Okay, maybe, but we understand that sometimes it's based on the nature of the climate that you are in, and it's okay to have one climate in this city and a totally different climate in another city. So why should this specific area really be any different? Therefore, since Nineveh's needs were analogous to those of central Spain, everyone would agree that in Spain, one should recite Mashiv HaRuach Umorid HaGeshem and V'tein Talu Matar according to the regional climate conditions. And at the end of his responsa, so basically the Rush held, so when do you say V'tein Talu Matar? You say it in the blessing of Birkat Hashanim for when your community needs it. And it's totally based on where you live, and you don't have to have this just general standard approach for the entire diaspora. It's ridiculous.
But Mashiv HaRuach stays always in the same place, in the same time.
So it would seem that probably would end up moving along with V'tein Talu Matar as well. As to why, that's also slightly complex, but you assume that they mostly will move together for now.
It makes sense.
Yeah, okay. Here's the best part. At the end of his response, the Rush notes that he was unsuccessful in changing the practice of his community, right? So the rabbi got up and said, here's what we're going to do. And everyone said,
no,
we're not. And that he, much less respectful than in Rochester, and that he himself eventually stopped reciting these prayers after Pesach, right? So the Rush woke up and said, everyone, here's the halacha. Everyone says, no way, Rabbi. He fought for a couple of years, and eventually he realized he lost. So he said, okay, I'll do what you guys are doing. And so he stopped following his own opinion. We see clearly that he had not changed his opinion. However, since he was not successful in changing the accepted practice, he did not want there to be divergent approaches in the same community. Okay. The Rush contended that he could prove that the Rambam also held as he did, that one should recite the prayers of Mashiv HaRuach and V'tein Talu Matar according to the need of the local region. So he goes through a whole reasoning why that's the case. So here we have the opinion of the Rush, who, again, in our terms would be translated in a very clear way. When it's the rainy season in the northern hemisphere, we say V'tein Talu Matar and we say Mashiv HaRuach. When it's the rainy season of the southern hemisphere, which again, for our purposes, we'll assume simply that it's the inverse of the northern hemisphere, so they say it, V'tein Talu Matar, and they say Mashiv HaRuach at basically the opposite times. And so one would assume, therefore, that many of the differences that you have according to seasons could theoretically be applied and follow a similar pattern. That maybe what we do in the spring in the northern hemisphere, we should do that in the spring of the southern hemisphere, and vice versa. Okay, with that said, let's take a look at the Kesef Mishnah. So the Kesef Mishnah is one of the major commentaries on the Rambam, the same person who wrote the Shulchan Aruch, who wrote the Beit Yosef. It's also the author of the Kesef Mishnah. And take a look at what he says. He says, if the Rambam meant to distinguish between a city and a region, he should have said so. Rather, they contend that the Rambam meant that if in your location there is now a need for rain, one should include Vitein Talamutter in your daily weekday davening. Where in the prayer one recites this depends on what part of the year it is. Between the 7th of Marcheshvan and Pesach, one should say it in Birkat Hashanim. If it's after Pesach, one should say it in Shomei Tefillah, right? So according to most of the commentators, the Rambam's opinion is in conflict with the Rush. That is, if you live in an area that it is a rainy season, but it's not like that in the rest of the Northern Hemisphere, you can and should ask for rain, but in the blessing of Shomei Tefillah, where you have your individual blessings, and not in the blessing of Birkat Hashanim, where you would normally have the communal blessings that are made. So, with all of this said, we have this very clear conflict between the Rush and the Rambam. The Rush, who is, in this context, comes out looking a lot more logical, and the Rambam, who's maybe a little bit less, and when we say logical, we mean for our simple understanding of things, right? But the Rush is basically saying, just do what you would think you should do. If it's the rainy season, so assume that that's how you should pray for your area. Oh, it's different than the rest of the Northern Hemisphere. Okay, so what? Just actually pretend to understand the words that you're saying in your davening, and if you could understand them and relate to them, then you'll see that it doesn't make sense to say them at this time, but it makes sense to say them at that time, and so on and so forth. So the Rush is, again, seems much more, let's call it palatably logical, whereas the Rambam says, no, listen, we have to have some general conformity among all of our Jewish communities, and so even if the rainy season is a little bit different in your community, follow the rest of the Northern Hemisphere, but if you have to ask for rain, do it in your individualized time, in your Shomei Tefillah blessing. And the Shulchan Aruch ends a paskening, like the Rambam, that we assume that you have to conform to the rest of the communities. If you have a little bit of a different kind of a community with a different kind of a climate, that's very nice, but you can't change the davening. You have to go ahead and assume that your need for rain in the summer months should be asked for simply in your individualized Shomei Tefillah blessing. And so that's how we paskin according to Halacha. Again, no one yet was talking about the Southern Hemisphere. Everyone was still only talking about the Northern Hemisphere when you have these different oddball cities that don't fit into the rest of the general region of the Northern Hemisphere. But that is the opinion that is what we follow according to Halacha. Now, of course, comes this question, okay, what if you have a whole part of the world that is the exact opposite of the part of the world that we knew and loved for thousands of years, namely the Southern Hemisphere? And so this really only came up for the first time when? Not after the Holocaust. There were no Jews in the Southern Hemisphere until after the Holocaust.
It
started coming up after the Spanish Inquisition, right? When Jews really started to get out there in the world and they had to look for other places to live, and Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492, right? So that's when people started to realize that there's this whole other part of the world. And the first time that we have any sort of response or written about this is in 1647. In 1647, there was a posek, a rabbi by the name of Rav Chaim Shabtai, and he was asked this question by a Jewish person living in Brazil. And Brazil, as we know, is Brazil in the Southern Hemisphere?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Trick question. Parts of it are, parts of it aren't. Ask me when I learned that. A week ago, when I started, right? So Brazil is partially in the Southern Hemisphere and partially, mostly in the Southern Hemisphere, but also partially a little bit in the Northern Hemisphere. So obviously, the person was asking from a community that is in the Southern Hemisphere, and so this is the first time that this question had to be addressed. And again, the reason why this is qualitatively different than any question that was dealt with until now related to this is because until now we were simply talking for the most part about a city, maybe even a larger area than a city, but it was all in the same general context of, okay, it's winter, it's summer, we know what it is. The Southern Hemisphere was just so different. It was the total opposite because of how the earth was tilted, and so the seasons were totally different, and so now maybe we should go ahead and change things a little bit. So here is what Rabbi Shabtai Shabbatai said. His undated response, we're in the middle over here in source number 8. His undated response is addressed to someone inquiring about the practices of the Jewish community in Brazil, without identifying which city in that country. The Teshuvah identifies them as being south of the equator, which is indeed where almost all of Brazil is located. The letter could not have been from the two largest communities in Brazil today, Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro, because neither of those cities existed yet in the 17th century. Okay. The questioner assumes that rain during these summer months, which are between Sukkot and Pesach, would be harmful. Right? So this is the big assumption that this whole thing is based on, which is, who's to say? It's not immediately the opposite. If in the Northern Hemisphere, the rainy season is during the winter months, well, if the whole climate is different down in the Southern Hemisphere and it's the total opposite, it doesn't mean that it works out perfectly opposite for the rainy season as well. But the assumption that the questioner was making was that it should be just like the seasons are the inverse, so too should the rainy season be the inverse as well. So therefore, the Brazilian community wanted to recite Mashiv HaRuach U'Morid HaGeshem and V'tein Talumater between Pesach and Sukkot, and not recite them between Sukkot and Pesach, meaning they wanted to do the inverse of what the Northern Hemisphere was doing. In essence, the people of Brazil wanted to follow the approach of the Rush, right? The Torah's Chaim rules that they should not follow this practice, emphasizing three reasons why not. Number one, the Rush's approach was not accepted by other authorities. Number two, in a lengthy discussion of the Rambam's opinion, the Torah's Chaim concludes, that's Rabbi Shabtai, concludes that the Rambam also does not agree with the Rush. And number three, the Rush himself didn't agree with the Rush at the end of it all. And so why should anyone follow the Rush? And so therefore, based on the claim that rain between Sukkot and Pesach was detrimental to life where these Brazilian colonists lived, the Torah's Chaim did rule that they should never recite Mashiv HaRuach U'Morid HaGeshem at all. So that was never part of their davening, right? Because just because you aren't allowed to make an insertion doesn't mean you also have to ask for something that's totally ludicrous. This is specifically following the Rambam, that one does not recite either Mashiv HaRuach or V'tein Talumater when it is detrimental for the local needs. And during the months that the Brazilians needed the rain, he ruled that they should recite V'tein Talumater during Shomea Tefillah, as if it was an individualized prayer, like the practice of the city of Nineveh, and unlike the Rush. Now it seems like, as we like to think in the 21st century, that time stood still for another few hundred years until this came up again, and big time this came up again, with an individual by the name of Rabbi Avraham Aver Hershowitz, who was a rabbi in Melbourne for 2 years. He was only in there in 2 years, and then 2 years after being there, he went to Toledo, Ohio. But these 2 years, he totally uprooted everything they knew in Australia and for all Southern Hemisphere Jewry. Basically, he was troubled that everyone should be following this Torah's Chaim. Who says that everyone follows this opinion of Rabbi Shabtai? And maybe we should be actually following the Rush, not what Rabbi Shabtai says. So therefore, he ends up paskening that we should go ahead and have a general policy for all areas outside of Israel. Basically, he said, very, very simple, what do you do in the Southern Hemisphere? Exactly what you do in the Northern Hemisphere. Entirely. There should be no difference. So, if it's January 1st in New York, your davening will look the same as January 1st in Australia. Nothing else to talk about. Because it's ridiculous. You're going to have Jews davening totally different prayers. So that was his psak. Now, the problem becomes when we have the opinion of Rav Vosner. So he has a long teshuva over here. We're not going to read through it, but I did put it here just for appearances and to keep me honest. If anyone wants to read through it another time, let me know. But basically, Rav Vosner says that everyone that has ever tried to answer, Rav Vosner is a contemporary person, a contemporary gadol. But he says that everyone that has ever approached this question is approached it totally incorrectly. He says that everyone is failing to recognize and understand that every question that has been answered by the Gemara referring to the city of Nineveh, by the Rambam, by the Rush, all of these people we're all talking about a world that was solely based in the Northern Hemisphere. And what that means is that even though your opinions might be specific for this city of Nineveh or whatever that has a different climate, that's only in Northern Hemisphere language. But he says, of course, if the Gemara understood and recognized that there was a Southern Hemisphere, of course they would have gotten with the program and they would have shifted the tefillot that would make sense accordingly with the climates of the Southern Hemisphere. So says Rav Vosner, in the Southern Hemisphere, not only is it incorrect to follow the opinions that say that we should be doing this uniform approach, it's actually prohibited to daven like that. Why? Because if you are asking for something in the Southern Hemisphere, well, let's say it in our language first. If you're in the Northern Hemisphere and you're asking for rain when it's not supposed to rain, not only are you asking for something that's not possible, but you're also asking God to literally change nature just for you because you're uncomfortable with your changing of your tefillah. So he says, what, you're uncomfortable changing your davening, and so now we're going to literally be asking God to uproot the regular nature patterns of the Southern Hemisphere? Totally ridiculous. So says Rav Vosner, the Southern Hemisphere should follow what makes sense in the Southern Hemisphere, which is basically inversing what we have in the Northern Hemisphere. Okay, what do people do nowadays? So it's actually fascinating. You go to different communities in different parts of the Southern Hemisphere, in Australia, in Brazil, South Africa, and everyone does something different. They're all good Jews. That's how you know they're all Jews, because they're all doing something different. And really, all of these opinions are certainly followed across the board. But I believe that, by and large, the most followed opinion is that of just conforming to what the Northern Hemisphere Jews are doing. Doesn't mean that there is not a request for rain added into the Shomea Tefillah part of the paragraph in the... when it is the rainy season there, but the conformity, I believe, seems to have won over more than most of the other opinions. Now, the Aruch HaShulchan, Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein, one of the great rabbis of towards the end of the 1800s, he makes the following claim, and he says, we'll read it in the Hebrew, we'll translate it. The Hebrew is very strong. He says, the Anan b'nei chutz la'aretz, Basar b'nei Bavel garinan kimo b'chol hadinim. He says, I don't understand. Southern Hemisphere, Northern Hemisphere. Who cares about all of this? We have always, as Jews of the diaspora, we have always been following the climate of Bavel. That's really what it comes down to. We follow the Babylonian Talmud, and we just follow what the rabbis in Bavel said about Bavel. That does not mean that in New York or in Poland or Europe, that the weather always lined up exactly with Bavel. But since the rabbis of the Gemara were, you know, the last generation who were rabbis who were really putting out sort of like innovative Torah, that's who we follow, and that's really where the buck stops. And so the Aruch HaShulchan says, V'chol ha'mepak b'kvazeh ra'oi l'onish. If you ask any more questions, you're going to get punished. Stop looking into it. Stop worrying about it. Just forgive me for saying, just get in line and just do it. And so again, a little bit harsh. People who know the Aruch HaShulchan also know that the Aruch HaShulchan was probably one of the most lenient poskim. He was a shul rabbi. That's why he was very lenient. So well, one of the most lenient poskim that we find. But in this area, he's very sharp. He just says, listen, let's just do what everyone else is doing based on the psak that was given by the rabbis in Bavel in the times of the Gemara, and just call it a day. Now, again, so nowadays, contemporarily, there really are many different opinions that are followed. And if you ever find yourself in a community in the Southern Hemisphere, I would probably make the argument of just following whatever that shul that you're davening is doing, just to make your life a lot easier. But a few additional points that are really important to be brought up. The first is, why does this conversation only exist with V'tein Talumatar and Mashiv HaRuach, and not some of the other larger questions, right? Like, why doesn't it come up so much? Like, why is no one suggesting that we should celebrate Pesach and Sukkot at the inverse times of the year in the Southern Hemisphere? Why is it only this, like, davening question, but for nothing else? Okay, good.
Because Pesach is tied to the to the particular month of the first month of the year.
Okay, good. So Jim says correctly, well, the holidays are tied to the Torah's decisions, right? So the rabbis, the Anshei Knesset HaGadola, whoever it was who developed certain parts of our prayer, that is clearly all rabbinic in invention, and so we have much more flexibility. The Torah is the one that says that Pesach is the 15th of Nisan, and the 15th of Nisan is the same date, whether you're in the Northern Hemisphere or the Southern Hemisphere. And so to change that is a lot more complex than changing a few words in davening. And so therefore, no one makes a suggestion like doing something like that. But what that does for us is really raise what hopefully will be the last few minutes of the discussion, which is, number one, why do the rabbis really seem to be so unaware of the Southern Hemisphere, which sounds a little bit of what we call, we used to call in yeshiva, klatz kasha. But in other words, obviously the rabbis didn't know about the Southern Hemisphere, but like, we believe that our rabbis had some sort of like, you know, divine understanding. They had Ruach HaKodesh. They had something in order to develop the Talmud. So why did our rabbis seem to be totally unknowledgeable about the Southern Hemisphere? That's question number one. Not as powerful of as the next question, but still an important one to contend with. And number two, why does the Torah not seem to know, right? Like, why is the Torah telling us that you should celebrate Pesach on the 15th of Nisan if the 15th of Pesach is supposed to really be celebrated in the spring and Sukkot in the fall? Why not just leave it almost blank and say celebrate it in this season, because the Torah should know that eventually the Southern Hemisphere will be discovered and eventually they should just celebrate it in their spring and they'll do it in their, right? Why not do it like that? So that's a really large theological question. And so let's deal with the rabbi's question first. And really, to answer the rabbi's question, you have to ask a much scarier one, which perhaps you've never thought of until right now. And I'm excited to be the one to burst your bubble. And that is the question of, did the rabbis think that the world was flat? Right? We don't think about it, but a lot of people thought the world was flat. And so it would make sense if the rabbis thought it was, because they're sort of in that right time, you know, in human history. So take a look. There's a really fascinating piece.
They had enough tourists already. Why say the world isn't flat?
Right. Right, so Rabbi Natan Slifkin, who is a fascinating person, who he's like one of these guys who like loves to deal with controversial issues, and he is controversial as a result. But he is a totally reliable source for these types of things. He's known as the zoo rabbi. Also, he's very into animals. Anyways, take a look at what he writes. He says the Talmud's discussion concerning the sun's path at night strikes many readers as being quite extraordinary. First, there is the matter of the Jewish sages holding a view of the universe that is very, very wrong. That there is Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi deciding that the Gentiles are correct and the revered Jewish sages are in error. Right? So first of all, not only are the rabbis potentially mistaken with their understanding of what the world, you know, what the celestial bodies look like, but actually Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the greatest rabbi, the compiler of the Mishnah, he goes ahead and says that the sages got the science wrong and the non-Jews got the science right. So that's like strike number one, right? So, and as Rabbi Dr. Isidore Twersky notes, the passage has a long history of interpretation, reflecting various moods, embarrassment, perplexity, satisfaction, with some attempts at harmonization or reinterpretation, or restricting the significance of the report. But the pattern of this history of interpretation is interesting. For the Gaonim and the Rishonim, which are the rabbis that came after the times of the Mishnah and the Gemara, there was absolutely no doubt that the Talmud was discussing a dispute about astronomy, and for the overwhelming majority of them, it was to be straightforwardly understood as attesting to the sages having been in error. Most reported this in a matter-of-fact way, apparently not seeing it as cause for concern, while for some it was positive testimony of the sages' intellectual honesty and evidence that they were not infallible. Right. So this is a larger discussion, but essentially Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi brought this challenge based on the non-Jewish scientists, and the rabbis had to come to terms with the fact of, oh, you know, maybe they were incorrect. The only dissenting voice of that time, Rabbeinu Tam, was not necessarily motivated by any consideration other than the fact that he genuinely believed that the sun did indeed go behind the sky at night. Beginning in the 16th century, this all changed. Rama insisted that the Jewish sages must have been correct due to their great stature, even if they did not know how to explain why they were correct. Right, so that's starting to get a little dangerous. And Maharal innovated an entirely new method of ensuring that the sages remained infallible by attributing an entirely different meaning to their words, according to which they were not speaking at all about the difference between Babylonian and Ptolemaic cosmology. These approaches were to prove very popular, even while there were still those who could not ignore the straightforward and traditional meaning of the text, namely that the rabbis were wrong. As rationalism declined, as the perceived nature of the stature of the Talmudic sages became ever more elevated, and as the worlds of the Talmud became perceived as ever more full of depth, such reinterpretations became increasingly desirable. In traditionalist circles today, on the rare occasions when this passage in the Talmud is discussed, the only approaches to be cited on this topic are those of Rabbeinu Tam and or the Maharal, meaning all the ones who say that the rabbis are right and that the non-Jewish perspectives were incorrect. And so essentially what we see over here, and I apologize, the truth is it's like a 31-page essay, and this is just a paragraph from it. But basically, his point is that, listen, it's okay to come to terms with the fact that the rabbis got something wrong scientifically, and that should not have any infringement on our faith or our emuna. Our rabbis were fallible individuals, not in the realms of halacha and not in the realms of the transmission of the Torah, but there were scientific limitations, right? So one of the other ones that the cynics like to point out nowadays, which is sort of on a similar plane, is mixing meat and fish together, right? So Ashkenazim, Sephardim, I believe as well for the most part, unless you're a renegade Sephardi, most of us don't put meat and fish together. Why not? Because the rabbis of the Talmud say, because it's dangerous. Is it really dangerous? No, but we do it nowadays because that was the scientific understanding of the rabbis, and we have such respect for their general opinions that even nowadays we continue to follow it just because we respect their stature offering advice, even when it may not reflect the same scientific reality. And so too here as well, when it comes to their perspective of the cosmos, maybe it was wrong, likely it seems to have been wrong, and it's okay. You know, we shouldn't lose sleep over it. There were many people who were wise in the non-Jewish world who didn't understand, and God had no reason to reveal to them more, and we have no reason to feel slighted because they didn't know more. The larger question is because of the Torah, and I put that question out to you to start. Why does the Torah not give us any sort of an inkling that the Southern Hemisphere exists? It really is a difficult theological question because of the fact that we want to believe strongly as Orthodox Jews that the Torah is of divine origin and not, God forbid, like others say the documentary hypothesis and the like, that maybe it is not divine origin, right? If the Torah is not of divine origin, then the fact that the author missed the Southern Hemisphere shouldn't shock anyone. But if it is, as we believe, of divine origin, then you would hope that it should be mentioned or noted to, or at least room left for it to exist. So how do we deal with it? Any thoughts?
It seems like the Torah deals with a specific geographical area. It talks about the Exodus from Egypt. It talks about entering the land. And it talks about commandments. When you enter the land, you read blah, 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 blah. It doesn't seem to me that there's any need for the Torah to talk about the Southern Hemisphere. It's talking about a specific situation.
Okay, good. So reason number one that we can turn to is that primarily the Torah was dealing with the situation of the Jewish people living in Israel, and therefore it's not even that the Torah doesn't speak about the Southern Hemisphere. The Torah doesn't really speak about the Northern Hemisphere. It just speaks about primarily one country. And so what? So the Southern Hemisphere isn't mentioned? Too bad. That was not the focus of the Torah. Good. So that's one potential approach that we can take. What's another approach? Any other thoughts? Yeah?
The Torah may have included all of that, but the Torah was given to man. Man's fallible. Maybe we don't remember the parts that it would have been.
Oh, okay. I like the first part. I don't like the second part. The second, we believe that whatever the Torah that was given to Moshe from God, that the text that he wrote down is exactly what God said. And so we can't think for a moment that there was any sort of mistake in that transmission. But the first part of what you're saying, we'll just hold on to that, which is that the Torah is actually, there's a general principle that the rabbis have, which is Dibra Torah Kelashon B'nei Adam, that the Torah speaks in a language that the people can understand. And which people? Well, specifically, the people of the generation in which it was received. And now, right, we have to spend our time trying to figure out what some of these things mean when we don't speak like biblical Hebrew. We use modern Hebrew, and so we don't always understand these things. Case in point, right? So one of the biggest challenges to the beauty and the divine origins of the text of the Torah is ayin tachas ayin, right? An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. The reason why it's such a complicated theological question, going into that realm for a moment, is because that's not unique for the Torah. Where else do we have an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth? What other legal texts?
Hammurabi's.
Good, Hammurabi's code. And which came first, the Torah or Hammurabi's code? Hammurabi's code. And so shouldn't we be bothered by the fact that the Torah seems to be copying Hammurabi's code? The answer, no. Why? Because Dibra Torah Kalashon B'nei Adam. The Torah spoke in a language that the people understood. Do you think that the people knew what Hammurabi's code was back then? There's a good chance that a lot of them were familiar with Hammurabi's code. And so if that's the case, it would make sense that you would speak in a language that mimics what Hammurabi's code is. But of course, we don't interpret it the same way as Hammurabi's code interprets it. But with this general principle, if the Torah speaks in a language that that generation was meant to understand, well, that generation didn't know of a southern hemisphere. And so therefore, perhaps there are deep allusions, you know, somewhere deep in the text of the Torah, but on a surface level, you don't have any mention of a southern hemisphere because that generation didn't know of a southern hemisphere. So they wouldn't even comprehend for a moment what it means. That's second possibility. The third possibility, which is probably the strongest likelihood, is that the Torah is not here to give us information about everything, right? Well, I don't know. Why didn't the Torah tell us about electricity? Well, you know, why didn't the Torah tell us about iPads and iPhones and can we use them on Shabbos? The Torah doesn't even tell us about 99% of the laws of Shabbos. You know, the Torah is not meant to be an information packet. The Torah is meant to be, all right, different perspectives as to what the Torah actually is meant to accomplish. Some it's a law book. Some it's meant to instill a sense of Jewish roots. There's lots of different perspectives you could take over here, but it's definitely not meant to be an all-encompassing guide of information. And so, if the Torah left out this one element that certainly was not relevant for most of human history, right? Even if you take now our knowledge of the Southern Hemisphere, we haven't known of the Southern Hemisphere for most of human history, and so therefore it shouldn't really be super relevant. And so to the people who are reading the Torah for most of the time that we've had it. And so therefore, what it really comes down to is that the fact that it's not mentioned in the Torah, although I think it's a worthwhile question, I don't think and it should give us pause. I think that either one of these three perspectives are definitely potential approaches that we could have, and there probably are others as well. These are sort of just a few that I came up with myself, and I was thinking about it. It's interesting to note that not that this means much, but I was not able to find a single written source that deals with this question. So maybe I'm just an idiot for thinking it's a good question. If it is a good question, then here are three potential answers for it. And with that, basically, we see at the end of the day, one of the reasons why this topic really pulled me in is because it's such a great example of how our Torah does have this eternal value to it, that even when there are issues that seem to be so out of left field and so foreign to so much of the general black and white understanding of the Torah, even so, the Torah still has what to say about it. And so I hope this made some sense to those of you who are listening, and happy to answer any questions if there are. But if not, I wish everyone a beautiful evening.